I'd like to begin by discussing my title a little bit, Plotting, Walking into Fiction. Well, often you're asked to produce a title like this and come up with something that you think is appropriate. About a day after, my partner pointed out that there was a certain redundancy in plotting and walking, much the same thing. Well, there is a nuance which I'll draw out later on. I've introduced it as both a literal description of the role of walking in creativity and creating ideas for literature, and also as a metaphor for the process of creation. When I was interviewed by Radio Adelaide yesterday, another buried meaning in the title was brought out, I thought quite ingeniously, by the reviewer. He said, walking into fiction, it's a little bit like walking into a door, isn't it? As though I was a domestic violence victim, and I can picture the implication that I'd come off rather the worse for wear from the encounter. I wanted to start by describing a few little anecdotes of my experience walking. Fiction writers love detail, the telling detail that tells a broader story, and so a lot of the talk is going to be anecdotal. And basically, my talk is a description of the journey that made this novel what it is. So, the year that I was in Berlin, as Anne described, it was an Australian backpacking trip away for a year. One of my first stops was Venice, because my family background is part Italian, part Venetian, and so, like a lot of young Australians, I was travelling to Europe to unearth something about my own identity, which, and of course, like many of us, we discover in the process just how profoundly Australian we are, that the very process of questioning our identity is a fundamentally Australian activity. A young Venetian would never question in the same way who and where they belong in the world, at least. They might question other things. Arriving in Venice for the first time, of course, and trying to walk to find Piazza San Marco, experienced that many of you might have shared of naturally being lost in the maze of streets. And coming through this maze and moving feelingly to where the map told me the piazza was, I came out, and as you are in Venice, suddenly surprised by the colonnades and the opening space of this vast, beautiful, stunning piazza. There were the cafe tables lined, I could see as I walked through the colonnade, and the moment that my heel struck the pavement, an orchestra struck up Vivaldi's Four Seasons. Just one of those experiences on the hoof. Also in Rome, six years later, one of those strange, never inexplicable experiences that never really has any explanation. I, by this stage, spoke some Italian, but walking through a small back street piazza with a few shops lined, I saw what you often see in Italy, a dispute, a loud, ferocious argument between a man in his 30s, perhaps a woman in her 20s, a group of avid spectators. They were speaking way too fast for me to actually understand their Italian. And in the midst of this, the young woman grabbed her shirt and tore it up to expose her bare breasts. I tell that story because it was utterly beyond me to understand the context. But it's, this experience that you have as you go out and walk and you let your imagination fly. Was she being accused of being a shoplifter? To this day, it's just a matter that astounds me. Perhaps a slightly darker incident in 2005 in the Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne. Walking with some friends and coming across a very distressed family, a couple in their 30s who'd evidently lost a young child. And that moment of mounting panic there. There are a couple of staff members there already, a couple of gardeners and someone from the office. And because I was trying to be helpful, I approached and said, look, could you describe the child? Can I help? Can we look out? And what was so startling about it was the look of hostility and suspicion from the woman who had taken charge of the situation. Who are you? Are you the perpetrator? And of course, that's an incident that will no doubt find its way into my fiction, that sort of startling experience that you can have on the street, or in this case, in the park. Dickens is said to have attempted to walk for as many hours a day as he spent at his desk, at least 5 hours. And of course, London of his time must have been an astonishing spectacle. There's lots of theory about the flaneur, that French expression of the walker in an urban environment, and lots of theory that I don't pretend to understand, often film theory, about the recording eye, this, and about modernity, the way that it's only latterly that people will walk through a street in a disinterested sense, that traditional meaning of the word disinterested, of not having a stake in what's going on, because for the first time perhaps people such as Dickens had leisure to just be out as an observer rather than to be going about their business. So there's a lot of theory and thoughts and ideas behind this experience of being out there in the world. But, there's a but, the early 20th century novelist Ivy Compton Burnett made the statement, which has some resonance with me, that she'd always found life quite hopeless for books. What she found useful for books was other books. And I think this is to a large degree true. For all the years that I've spent plodding the streets, I've perhaps only had a handful of really vivid experiences, but of course we draw our ability to write, our understanding of the grammar of storytelling from our reading of other books. That would make a less interesting speech, however, to describe my reading experience than what I would like to deliver here today. I'd like to talk really about some of the real world experiences that inspired the novel, but just bear in mind perhaps that sense in which a lot of the writer's territory, a lot of the creative territory is an interior space. I only read today a quote that perhaps I should have picked up in previously. In Andrew Goldsmith's new novel, Reunion, she speaks about Nietzsche talking about the greatest ideas come from walking. And I've also, just a week ago, walked off the Larapinta Trail in Northern Territory. Feels I can vouch for this, that walking day in and day out, and certainly ideas for a third novel sort of seeming to fall fully formed into my mind. It's a wonderful experience, conducive to creativity. The Zookeeper's War, just a brief summary of what it is so that you know, in a sense, what I was working towards ultimately without knowing it. It's the story of Vera Frey, an Australian woman who in the 1930s marries the director of the Berlin Zoo and spends the war looking after the animals through the bombing. It's perhaps an unusual choice for a first novel, although I had actually written a novel prior to that, which was mercifully unpublished, that was set in Australia. But hopefully by describing my experiences in Berlin, you'll have some, at least, understanding of how that came about. And by telling this, perhaps to throw some light on the process of creativity itself, once again being the writer hoping that the particular will tell the whole. I arrived in Berlin as an unemployed youth of 20, 1986, 3 years before the Berlin Wall fell. I'd intended to find work there, but that didn't come off. So instead I wandered the streets in an often melancholy fug, experiencing the late autumnal cityscape and moving into winter. And when I was too cold to keep walking, I'd go and retreat into the British Council Library and read. So even though my real world experiences were in a sense reading experiences, I was completely absorbed by the atmosphere of melancholy and menace that I suspect possibly still exists in Berlin. Berlin's a city that keeps reforming and completely changing itself. But I responded to this atmosphere. If you walked in any line for long enough, you'd ultimately bump into the wall, because of course Berlin was not only divided down the middle, but West Berlin was an island with a wall that completely enclosed it. In terms of why I responded to this city and chose a European setting for this novel as opposed to an Australian one, I half joke, but only half joke, that it was partly the result of being an inmate for 7 years as an adolescent in a boys' boarding school. And while I don't mean to equate the experience of being in a boys' boarding school with being in a totalitarian regime, and yet, you know, there are some definite parallels. You know, what I've brought out in the novel and responded to when I was there was the sense of sort of confinement, entrapment, enclosure, coercion, surveillance. So I think it's no mistake if anyone's looking for, or if I'm trying to explicate to myself how this came about. The wall, I've described how you would bump into it in due course. And if you were to walk up to the wall at that stage, there were often platforms around what is now Potsdamer Platz, and you could actually clamber up and look over the wall. And invariably, an East German border guard in a nearby tower would swivel their binoculars onto you. And as I said, that very evocative, that sense of surveillance at the time. There'd be a minefield, barbed wire, and graffiti. Another coincidence this evening, I was speaking with a gentleman, the father of a friend of mine from Melbourne this evening in the audience, Russell, and he talked about his wartime experience in Barrow-on-Inverness. One of the graffitos that I particularly responded to on the wall that you can picture on the western side, this is constant spray painting and pictures and graffiti, was, "This is naff all compared to the slag bank at Barrow-in-Furness." So there were all sorts of... and I'm just going to read to you briefly from my second published story called... It's very much inspired by that time. "Alexandra in a Walled City" was the title I chose. I had as my narrator in this story a very naive, innocent young man, a type of Candide, I suppose, but if anything, even more innocent and naive. And I'm just going to read Alexander's encounter with the wall. "Alexander read the graffiti on the Berlin Wall. One inscription said, 'Home lies over the sea, but Berlin is in my blood, which is smeared on this wall.' That was pretty awful. The writing was in red, but it wasn't really blood. There were clever paintings on the wall. One showed a superhero bursting through the bricks in the name of freedom. Another showed a beautiful garden through a pretend hole in the wall. Alexander climbed onto a wooden platform provided for looking over the wall. There was a big paddock on the other side of the wall and a wall on the other side of the big paddock. Alexander saw a guard in a watchtower looking at him through binoculars. Alexander felt uncomfortable, but when he thought about it, he decided that the guard must be pretty bored. That made Alexander feel sorry for him. There were rabbits in the paddock. Alexander wondered if the rabbits were in danger from landmines. Alexander imagined himself as a mother rabbit in a cosy burrow with lots of baby rabbits. He imagined half a landmine sticking into the burrow, and he imagined how the baby rabbits would have their eyes closed. A sign on the platform said that the paddock used to be Potsdamer Platz. It was the same place as the busy square in the etching on Alexander's wall. Alexander was sorry that Potsdamer Platz had become a paddock, but he was glad that the rabbits had a place to stay, however risky." So other places that I responded to definitely in the city were the tenements of Kreuzberg in particular. At the time, I was not able to extensively visit East Berlin, but, you know, pretty much a lot of the cityscapes that you see on your left were the places that I described. I wandered those streets, absorbing the sort of the darkness. There's a couple of images, second from the right over there, of the deep courtyards that the tenements have and the series of archways that can lead into them. I might just actually read briefly from the novel how those experiences and those observations contributed ultimately to the novel. Vera, the heroine in this scene, and her husband have been bombed out of their villa at the zoo and have been forced to take refuge in a flat in Kreuzberg, and they're on their way. Vera's on her way to see it for the first time. "A week into January, a letter came from the Reich Housing Authority announcing that a flat was available in Kreuzberg, south of the Mitte. And the next day, Axel left to take a look while Vera packed what little they'd salvaged from the villa. Axel returned in the afternoon and would only say that the flat was small. "Smaller than this?" she asked, sweeping an arm around Flavia's flat. He nodded and she didn't press for details. On a freezing winter's morning, they drove in the zoo's last lorry to 412 Reichenbergerstrasse, Kreuzberg, not far from where Herr Vincent's had moved in with his niece. The street had been heavily damaged by the bombing, its buildings blackened and the rubble swept into heaps on the pavements. "At least the streets are wide," said Vera, the only consolation she could find in the scene beyond the windscreen. "For a clear line of fire," said Axel. "Last century," he continued, "peasants had flocked here from the country to work in the new textiles and heavy engineering plants. The state was terrified," he said, "of an uprising and planned for it." He turned off the street and eased the lorry through an archway that ran beneath a tenement. Beyond this was a courtyard, 5 stories high, sunk in twilight like a castle keep. Masonry choked the corners. Overhead there were timber balks. 3 of the walls were windowed, the 4th a blank of bricks, snowflakes corkscrewed onto a cobbled pavement. So there was a very particular smell that I associated from my time in Berlin and Kreuzberg in particular, kind of a bitter smell that I thought was thoroughly evocative at the time. And when it came to write the novel, I thought I must find out what that smell was. I had some idea it might be coal burning from the coal heaters, and until I smelt it in inner city Fitzroy and realised it was roasted coffee, which didn't work for rationed World War II Berlin at all, so that had to go by the by. One of the oddities of Berlin before the wall came down was the patrols of the four powers, the rights that each had to patrol in each other's territory. So it meant that the Russians could come and actually patrol in West Berlin and the British, French or American sectors. And so on the rich, expensive shopping strip of the Kaffersendamm, you would see a Trabant full of Russian soldiers, Russian officers scooting down with their peak hats and so on. And another startling thing about the occupation I witnessed was a British chieftain tank going down the road of an arterial road in West Berlin. I always think when I see flyovers by Australian fighter aircraft, you know, how terrifying engines of war are and the notion of them turned on you. It's just almost impossible to imagine the terror that might be involved. I'm not sure how many people have seen a tank on the move, but it's astonishing and so large, so frightening. And what was the detail that caught my eye was it was tearing up the bitumen, the asphalt of the road. 45 years after the war, in the territory of, by that stage, a supposed ally, the British felt free to destroy the local infrastructure. And this was also something that found its way into the novel. In this scene, it's actually the day of the failed coup to topple the Nazis in Berlin, which was associated with the attempt to kill Hitler, assassinate Hitler in Wolf's Lair, many hundreds of kilometres to the east of Berlin, the subject of the recent Tom Cruise film Valkyrie. So on this day, Vera, ignorant of what's going on or what is about to happen, is out shopping. A fistful of mince with shreds of parsley, some sausage and offal. The butcher's fingers drummed the bench top while someone coughed with impatience in the queue. Through curved glass, Vera pointed at a slice of Rollfleisch, and at once the butcher plucked it from under her reflection, which was squashed as if by a fairground mirror. He wrapped the meat with 3 deft folds, stamped her card and handed over the parcel and the change. Outside, the afternoon was hot and still. Around the corner in Tauentzienstrasse, an army staff car sped past, lifting dust off the road. Trams were the only other traffic. Before the war, this had been a fashionable street, busy with cars and pedestrians, but windows were now boarded and the goods on display were often tagged not for sale. At this time of day, the pavements were bare. In Wittenbergplatz, she heard rumbling, and as she reached the top of the U-Bahn stairs, a tank burst from a side street and slewed into the Platz. The tank was grey, decked in camouflage, and startlingly fast. it straightened and veered towards her. A man wearing earphones stood erect in the turret, a stalk of flesh in metal. The ground vibrated. The machine filled two lanes. Behind it, a whole column thundered into the plats, cannons level and turrets sealed. The lead tank passed the U-Bahn entrance, snorting exhaust from a pipe at the rear. Its wheels screeched. At its prow, the teeth of the tracks bit the asphalt, stayed still for a moment, then reared at the stern, leaving a trail of indentations on the road. The column headed north into Ansbacher Straße, and the noise of the engines died away. So I think it's interesting that sometimes the details in a novel that you might think are research actually turn out to be personal experience and vice versa. I lived at that time in the suburb of Spandau in the western side of the city, and a suburban area. And I walked, after a week of being in Spandau, I walked past a building, a 19th century pile of castellations and fortifications. And what was striking about this building as I walked past was the trees outside bared by the oncoming winter. One of them was festooned with shreds of fabric. And what I discovered by asking my friends had happened is that a neo-Nazi had hurled a bomb through the gatehouse of what I learned was Spandau Prison, which at that stage had a single inmate, Hitler's one-time deputy, Rudolf Hess, who at that stage was 92 years old. Hess, as probably many of you know, was not executed because he was captured in 1941 when, probably having lost his marbles, he went on a solo peace mission to Britain and bailed out of his fighter plane over Scotland, over the property of the Earl of Northumberland, I think, who he'd met before the war and intending to make peace with the aristocracy, who were the true people he thought in control of Britain. He was rounded up by a ghillie with a fork and spent the war in that in Britain, and then subsequently imprisoned with Speer and others in Spandau until he was the only one left. There's lots of debates about why he was there into his old age, this harmless old Mandy. But and a couple of years after I was there, he hanged himself. Of course, I had no sympathy for that neo-Nazi bomb thrower, for his politics, and yet, of course, the writer in me responded. The antenna went up. The passion that is evident in an act like that, and Berlin is a city with a infamous history of bomb throwing. As a writer in Australia, it's sometimes difficult to see that passion evident. It's under the surface, of course. The first novel I mentioned that I wrote, set on the Franklin River dispute, Franklin River Dam. I began that after seeing a 4,000-year Huon pine and the Lower Gordon River, which Bob Brown had used as a place to give press conferences during the dam dispute, a sign of what it was that the Greens were fighting for. On the day that the High Court made its decision that the dam should not proceed, the workers on the dam went to that Huon and dynamited it. And there I was a few years later as a tourist and seeing this tree, which, by the way, was sending forth new shoots of life, but seeing, in Australia in particular, you don't often see that passion. So once again, I was focusing in and responded similarly to that bombing in Berlin, which fortunately no one was hurt. So at that stage, of course, I had no immediate notion that I'd write a novel about Berlin, but I thought that when I did finally come to that decision, I knew that it was going to have to be something urgent that was going to burst from the coffin of the past, that couldn't be safely historical and quaint. It had to be something immediate and visceral. So how did it come about? This is where I perhaps move on to plotting as a metaphor for the creative process, hoping to suggest the full difficulty and sometimes slowness in between, you know, spurts of joyful creativity. The first thing that I think got me thinking about that period, because of course I'd been there in the 80s, the first thing that got me thinking about the period immediately post-war, or the last stage of the war was listening to a documentary on Radio National called You Never Get Tired in Berlin, a reference to the Berliner Luft, the bracing air of Berlin, which is said to have sort of restorative properties and keeps you awake and alive and allows you to party all night. It was a series of interviews with eyewitnesses who'd experienced the hit Berlin directly from the period of the Third Reich all the way through to the Berlin Wall. And the story that's that really stood out for me was an account by a woman who was at the time 16 years old, describing the week after the fall of the city to the Russians and being desperately hungry and going out with her two younger sisters and seeing some men in the street butchering a horse. They went up to these men and begged for a part of the horse and were given the head, which they hefted home between them, dragged up the stairs of their tenement and presented to their mother, who freaked. But they insisted that she cook it. They were so hungry. And the mother finally relented on one condition, that they brush its teeth. And this is also an incident that found its way into the novel, which I won't read now. It's once again that startling anecdote, that startling story that becomes the important spur for creativity in fiction. What really fixed me, however, was reading an account of the zoo being bombed. In a popular history called The Fall of Berlin by David Reed and Anthony Fisher, and seeing this description of crocodiles hauling themselves into the sewers and animals on fire, it was a horrifying image, and I've had readers who, well, non-readers who can't begin my book because the notion of the suffering of animals seems to them far worse than even the suffering of children. Perhaps they're the animal-loving sector of our society, but it is interesting, and once again I'm attracted to that difficulty, that wincing away, that pain, as well as wanting to seduce my readers and interest them. I definitely want to challenge them as well. What I might do is briefly read the moment of inspiration, as it were, recorded from my journal way back in 1992, just to give you an idea of what a long process. I didn't start writing the novel until 1997, but you know, here is a 10-year process 5 years earlier. So I wrote in my diary, and in the middle of the night, as I recall, and which is unusual for me, to be bolt upright in bed with an idea that has to be expressed, and I'll read it with the appropriately breathless air. Ideas overflowing for a Berlin novel since I read The Fall of Berlin, a history of the city during the war. What took me by the scruff of the neck was the image of the city's zoo during the Allied bombing, especially the aftermath of a 1,000-pound bomb explosion in the huge glass crocodile enclosure. Stunned, bleeding crocodiles attempting to haul themselves through the rubble. Thousands of fish from the shattered aquarium gasping on the floor. Thought of using this as the central image of a story called The Zoo Garden, in which the zoo becomes a symbol of the crazy zone the city becomes in the last year of the war. The main character, an Australian woman in her 30s who has lived for 10 years in Berlin with her German husband. She works at the zoo in some capacity. So what's striking about that to me now is the extent to which the ultimate image remained true to that moment, first moment of inspiration. I'm going to allow time at the end for some questions, but just to give a little summary of where it was taken from there. I mentioned before plotting as a sort of metaphor for persistence, and there are writers, no doubt, who I envy enormously, who can only write perhaps at a ferocious pace in the heat of inspiration. But you know, my experience is that I've had to spend many hours of feeling very uninspired at a desk and just persisting. My observation about writing is that there's actually lots of people, it's not an uncommon skill to be able to write prose of a publishable standard, but what's unusual is having the idiocy perhaps to persist with this project that, you know, by any means is really illogical. It's certainly not a rational project monetarily until finally one day, strangely, it is. And And I think perhaps one has to have that personality. I'm not just a walker, but used to be a competitive runner. And I sometimes think, as a adolescent boy, that discipline, that temperament that made me want to escape my school and go out and pound the streets was a similar temperament that's allowed me to sit at my desk. And I've even discovered a strange skill, an aptitude for accountancy. I've done many jobs in my time and quite enjoyed the calming influence of sitting with an Excel spreadsheet in front of me and going, moving numbers around. So clearly I have a flair for the tedious. Plotting, as a metaphor almost perhaps for narrative itself, the journey that we go on, a narrative is, after all, one thing after another. Often modern fiction distorts the chronology and so on, but perhaps it's one of the remaining, enduring, essential lures of fiction as opposed, say, to poetry. I read recently Ian McEwan talking about how the central section of Atonement, he was struggling to make it work. He couldn't understand how he could make a description of the evacuation from Dunkirk work in the context of the story until he realised, aha, it's a hike. McEwan's a great walker, and by moving his character Robbie 20 miles away from the coast and turning that section of the novel into a hike to the coast, it suddenly made sense to him, which in turn put me in mind of all the other stories that are explicitly expressions of walks and journeys. Perhaps to name some of the more obvious, War and Peace, in which Pierre is roped in the most literal fashion into the retreat from Moscow. Ulysses, of course, is a flaneur novel par excellence of someone walking around the streets. And perhaps most striking, I think, the most popular book of the 20th century, Lord of the Rings. I remember reading Lord of the Rings as a 14-year-old and finding that a lot of the attraction of it was the notion of a walking journey, of being out in a landscape so long that you would actually see one range of hills behind you disappear and the other in front of you can't draw closer. And it's an experience that I've very much just had recently on the Larapinta Trail. So, look, I could describe much more of the plotting journey to final publication, and I'm certainly open to answer any questions about really anything I've spoken about, the novel itself, the process of getting it to publication. But I might just finally just read one more section from the novel, Walking. And this is Vera having just been bombed out. She's just taken, she's just gone to the air raid damage office to apply for help from the government. And she's been told to go away, we'll be in touch. And she's walking from the air raid damage office in the city to back to the zoo. Just take about 2 minutes. On the street, she wrapped a scarf around her head and put on sunglasses against flying cinders. Coal and lignite stored for the winter burned steadily in cellars, clogging the air. Although daylight was fading, the temperature was warm, a sinister Indian summer. In the Mitter, the old city, bombs had caved in the skyline, dropping telegraph poles, power lines and tram cables onto burnt-out lorries and trams. Shops were destroyed or boarded up, and glass, chunks of plaster and shrapnel paved the streets. Field kitchens had sprouted at the major intersections, and in alleys off Alexanderplatz, girls were already soliciting. Outside one bombed-out tenement, Vera read the chalked inscription, "Everyone in this shelter has been saved." Another around the corner, "My angel, where are you? Leave a message for your Siggy." In a house without walls on the Unter den Linden, a man played Bach on a grand piano, and below him, in a lake fed by a burst water main, a fur stole clung to a hat stand. Half the people on the streets wore a uniform, police, air raid wardens, women postal workers, soldiers moved in squads, and the only vehicles were staff cars and Wehrmacht lorries, as if the army had conquered Berlin and deployed clerks and shop assistants to the front in a fleet of private cars. For all the pre-war pre-war pomposity of Berlin, the Reich capital, Vera couldn't help grieving for that other Berlin, an unruly city whose emblem was a crudely depicted black bear. It was the city she had entered in 1934 after arriving by train at Bahnhof Zoo. I'm going to just leap over this little brief description of Vera's first arrival and take us back to the present time. Outside a bomb department on the Linden, some prisoners of war, Bergoglio Italians, pumped air into the ruins through a large canvas pipe, while Hitler youth and girls of the Bund Deutscher Mädel laboured in the wreckage. A row of bodies lay on the pavement, a scene she had witnessed after previous air raids, though not so often that she could look away. The nearest victim was an elderly woman, her skirts obscenely rucked to the waist. The Tiergarten was ploughed up like a Flanders battlefield, with many of its oaks and beeches shattered. Camouflage netting above Charlottenburger Chaussee had fallen on the road or vaporised. Vera turned into the park towards the zoo and the noise of lorries fell away. At the goldfish pond, she passed a marble statue of a bow-wielding Amazon on horseback, the arrow poised to fly eastwards towards Moscow. The trees thinned and through a gap in the branches, she glimpsed the tower bunker next to the walls of the zoo. Flak cannons gleamed on the roof. Rows of shuttered, slit windows made the tower resemble a castle keep. Beside it was a smaller but still imposing structure, the headquarters of Berlin's anti-aircraft defences, along with its own battery of cannon. Two dish-like aircraft detectors rotated on the battlements. At the Landwehr Canal, she crossed a footbridge that led to the zoo's northern gate. Behind her, the revolving dishes scooped the last of the sun. Thank you.